yeah, we have a decent shot at this. We really do.
Alaska has a new shot at a gas line with legislation signed into law today. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 8th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, charter schools prepare for a big funding boost thanks to the legislature.
We want to try to keep our education dollars as equitable as possible among all of our students, whether they're charter school students or students in one of our regular or traditional schools.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Surrounded by state legislators, cameras, and heavy machinery, Governor Sean Parnell signed a measure that could serve as a starting point for a major natural gas project. He put his name on the bill today at a pipeline training center in Fairbanks.
So with my signature today, Alaska will be on its way to becoming an owner in the Alaska LNG project, and the project will officially get underway.
The proposed natural gas project is seen as a lifeline for the state as North Slope oil production declines and state revenue dwindles. Its construction has also been attempted many times before without success. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez has the story.
More than 40 years ago, trillions upon trillions of cubic feet of natural gas were discovered on the North Slope. And ever since, Alaska's leaders have been trying to figure out a way to sell it.
In 1968, when they discovered oil and gas at Prudhoe Bay, the hope was you'd build a pipeline to take the oil to market, take the weekend off, turn the equipment around, and go build a gas line. Didn't happen.
That's Larry Persily. He's the federal coordinator for an Alaska natural gas pipeline, and he's worked on energy issues under three separate governors. In the 1970s alone, you had companies with names like Arctic Gas, El Paso, and Alaska Northwest all making plays to build a gas line. Congress was supportive, too. Permits were issued, federal regulations were met. There were a lot of people who wanted the project to work.
So you had three legit proposals in the 70s, none, as we know now, none of them worked out because of the economics.
The demand for natural gas just wasn't enough to justify tapping the supply. The price for natural gas was so low that there would be no way to cover the costs. And on top of that, natural gas on the North Slope had value insofar as it made oil recovery easier.
Everyone said, well, this isn't going to make any money, so no one wrote any big checks to order pipe or go ahead with it. That's a simple answer.
Through the decades, there were other private attempts at a gas line. And since the late 1990s, there have been three major legislative efforts to get a gas line built.
Stranded Gas Act 1 didn't work. Stranded Gas Act 2 didn't work. AGEA didn't work.
So what's different this time?
Well, what's different this time around is the state would be an investor. So when you think about a business, every dollar the state invests as a partner, the companies don't have to invest.
Governor Sean Parnell's gas line bill sets the state up as a partial owner of the project. The major North Slope producers, that is Exxon, BP, and ConocoPhillips, each get a 25% share in the project. The state of Alaska will also get a quarter. But it will be giving the pipeline building company TransCanada a cut to effectively serve as the state's bank. Instead of implementing a traditional tax on the natural gas, the state will simply get a share of the gas itself. Persily says the economics for selling the natural gas to Asia are different, too.
It wasn't until about 2008 that LNG prices in Japan looked to be high enough to actually cover the costs of an Alaska LNG project.
The politicians behind the bill are quick to call it the real thing. At Thursday's bill signing, more than one person said they believed this piece of legislation would truly get a gas line built. But there are skeptics, too. Gubernatorial candidate Bill Walker puts the odds that the legislation will lead to a gas line at zero. He says it commits the state to $100 million studies without a guarantee that anything will be built. For his part, Larry Persily is cautiously optimistic.
If the market grows like many people expect, if prices in Asia stay high, if the producers do their engineering, environmental, permitting work, and don't find any surprises, don't find any big problems in there, if the producers in TransCanada and the state can put together a deal that will pass the political test with the public and the legislature.
That's four ifs for those counting.
Yeah, we have a decent shot at this. We really do.
Lawmakers are hoping so, too. They'll revisit the deal in 2015 when they're presented with more enabling legislation to allow the project to go ahead. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin defended the oil tax structure she championed while in office, known as ACES. The system has been dismantled by state lawmakers and her successor, Governor Sean Parnell. Palin also took a swipe at Parnell on Anchorage radio station KWHL when asked about Parnell's change in direction, pointing out that Parnell came from the oil industry. Parnell was Palin's lieutenant governor from 2006 to 2009. Palin also had supportive words for a rival to Parnell in this year's gubernatorial race, Bill Walker, who is running as an independent. She didn't endorse Walker, but said he has, quote, his thumb on the pulse of most Alaskans who care about the future of this state. Walker said today he had not spoken with Palin and was surprised by her remarks. There's new evidence challenging the long-contested murder convictions of four Native men in Fairbanks. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the information was provided to the court by the Alaska Innocence Project in its effort to free the men known as the Fairbanks Four.
The documents provide further evidence that others are guilty of the 1997 beating death of Fairbanks teenager John Hartman. The information supplements requests for post-conviction relief filed on behalf of George Freese, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent last September. The centerpiece of the new documents is a memo from a guard at a California prison where a former Fairbanks resident is jailed for life for other murders. The memo details a December 2011 conversation between the guard and inmate William Holmes, in which Holmes says he and a group of friends randomly targeted John Hartman. It specifically pins delivery of the fatal blows on Jason Wallace, a man who's also jailed for another killing. Alaska Innocence Project Director Bill Oberle says the memo corroborates what Holmes later stated to the project in a sworn affidavit.
It is new evidence to us, as we were unaware of the memo until we received it from the state in February of this year.
A California state prison official sent the memo to Fairbanks police in December 2011, but police didn't forward it to the state until last fall when the Innocence Project filed the request for post-conviction relief. Police Chief Laren Zager says he didn't know about the memo until last fall, and in retrospect, it should have been handled more expeditiously. But considering the source, he has his doubts.
I think a person would be much more inclined to listen to the Pope than a convicted murderer in a California jail.
Zager says police have been working with the state's criminal division as it reviews all new evidence in the Fairbanks 4 case. The state is due to file its response to the request for post-conviction relief by May 15th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, seismologists scramble to install monitoring equipment near Noatak to study an unusual cluster of earthquakes.
Our objective right now is to get instrumentation in the ground quickly.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
There isn't a law school in Alaska, but the University of Alaska Anchorage is launching a new program to make it easier for Alaskans to attend law school. It's a partnership with Willamette University College of Law in Oregon. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Prospective law school students in Alaska face a lot of obstacles, including cost and having to attend school out of state. Deb Perryman is the UAA Legal Studies Program Coordinator. She says the goal is to create more options for Alaska students.
This partnership is designed as a way for very high-achieving, very highly motivated and focused students to reduce their education costs and be able to get that law degree and their undergraduate degree in 6 years rather than seven.
This approach is called a 3+3 program, and it's modeled after Willamette's current partnership with Oregon State University. Students will complete all the requirements for their undergraduate degree at UAA during their first 3 years, with the exception of a year's worth of general elective credits. For their fourth year of school, students will attend Willamette University College of Law before they receive their undergraduate degree, which Perryman says is unusual.
They'll complete their first year of law school, and what they'll do then is transfer those law school credits back to UAA as upper division elective credits, so essentially they'll be graduating with their baccalaureate degree after their first year of law school.
Perryman says the program will help ease some of the financial burden on students by eliminating the cost of the final year of undergraduate work, and it will increase graduates' earning potential by getting them into the workforce a year earlier. Curtis Bridgman is the dean of the Willamette University College of Law. He says there are a number of similarities between Willamette and UAA, so the partnership is a natural one.
We really focus on a student-centered education, and by that we mean the sort of education where the students aren't just a number. We really try to get to know them early on, get to know their goals for their career, and try to help them make connections that are going to lead to good employment outcomes.
One requirement of the program is after their first year of law school, students must return to Alaska to complete an externship or capstone project. The idea is to allow students to get firsthand experience with Alaska law and Alaska employers. With over 150 Willamette Law School graduates in Alaska, Perryman says there should be plenty of externship opportunities.
There's a tremendously active alumni association here and an association that takes a lot of pride in giving new graduates a leg up.
Job prospects bode well for students who graduate from the program. For the class of 2013, Willamette ranks fifth in job placement among West Coast law schools. Perryman says the program will kick off this coming fall and anticipates between 4 and 6 students being accepted each year. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The Juneau Community Charter School is getting a 56% increase to its budget through an upcoming change in state law. As KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, new mandates in House Bill 278 give charter schools more parity with other public schools.
Kindergarten and first grade students at Juneau Community Charter School are getting ready to go on a hike with substitute teacher Kelly Ord.
Every Tuesday we go on a nature hike to Basin Road, the front of Perseverance Trail, and there's a meadow out there where we just explore for about an hour, just being out in nature.
The Juneau Community Charter School opened in 1997 with 40 students in first to fourth grade. Since then, the school has grown. It now has 110 students in kindergarten through eighth grade. Prior to the Alaska Legislature passing House Bill 278, the projected budget for the Juneau Community Charter School was close to $1 million. Now, the school is looking at a budget of more than $1.5 million. HB 278 increases state funding for charter schools of a certain size. Of the 27 charter schools in the state, this only affects two: Juneau Community Charter School and Homer's Fireweed Academy in the Kenai School District. Les Morse is State Deputy Education Commissioner.
In the past, a school would have had to have been 150 students to get the same level of funding as many of the other schools in the state that are non-charters. And now it allows that school to start off at 75 students and still get the funding equitable to other schools.
Under HB 278, in addition to state money, school districts will be mandated to support charter schools with local government funds. Some districts were already doing this, some weren't. David Means is Director of Administrative Services for the Juneau School District.
In the past, we've only passed on money that we received from the state for the Juneau Community Charter School. Under HB 278, because we have a local match from the city and borough of Juneau over and above our state money, we have to pass on a share of that money onto the Juneau Community Charter School as well.
This accounts for about $300,000 of the charter school's new money, which would otherwise go to other district schools.
I think we want to try to keep our education dollars as equitable as possible among all of our students, whether they're charter school students or students in one of our regular or traditional schools.
Matt Jones is a charter school parent and vice president of the committee that manages the school.
At this point, we're now on the same footing as all the other neighborhood schools in the district, whereas we've been operating for the last 15 years on significantly lower funding than most schools do, so about 30% less than most schools.
Jones is also the treasurer of the committee. He says half the additional funding will likely go toward new staff, a facilitating teacher, a special education teacher, and a paraeducator or reading specialist. Another big issue is the school building. The charter school leases 1.5 floors of a commercial building. It's located downtown, walking distance to libraries, museums, and trails, but Jones says the space isn't set up for students in classrooms.
There's not a lot of space in the halls for students and for lockers and things like that, and there's no gymnasium. There's basically no room outside of the main classroom areas that we rent, and we're spread out across a couple of floors and kind of in this building that has other tenants in it.
Instead of a cafeteria, the charter school serves lunch in a narrow hallway. The students go to the Capitol Park playground because they don't have their own. The facade of the school building is discolored and chipping off. Jones says ultimately they'd like to move into a new space, potentially leasing from the school district. This would keep the money in the district instead of going to a private company. In the meantime, Jones says they'll spend a little to improve the space they're in now. HB 278 also requires school districts provide or pay for charter school students' transportation and offer extra classroom space to charter schools first. Deputy Education Commissioner Morse says HB 278 is the biggest change to the charter school law since it was created in 1995.
For some communities, certainly a charter would not have made sense, and now with some of these structural changes, it could make sense and it could give new opportunities for kids and families.
The governor is expected to sign HB 278 into law. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
State ferry service to Skagway resumes on Sunday. Alaska Marine Highway ferries have not been running to Skagway since the ferry dock there sank on April 24th. The state was able to contract with a marine salvage and repair company out of Juneau for an emergency sole source contract, and the dock was refloated a few days later. Since then, the company has been inspecting and repairing damaged parts of the dock. The likely cause of the sinking is a water pipe under the dock that burst, flooding the hollow compartments that keep the dock afloat. Repairs have also been made to the passenger ramp that was partially submerged, the electrical systems, and the vehicle ramp hydraulic system. To date, the salvage and repair costs have run about $500,000, according to the state. Permanent repair work will be ongoing, but not affect ferry service, according to a press release for the Marine Highway System.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
There could be more warm and cloudy weather on Alaska's coast and more wildfire danger in the interior this summer if a temperature trend in the waters of the Pacific Ocean along the equator continues. The National Weather Service's Climate Prediction Center today issued an El Niño watch, saying the weather pattern is more likely than not to develop this summer. Rick Toman is the Director of Climate Science and Services for Alaska.
At this point, it does look quite likely that we'll see that warmer water across the equatorial Pacific. That'll influence where those big thunderstorms develop in the tropics over the summer, and that pushes lots of heat and moisture into the mid and high latitudes of the Earth.
The moisture transported to the north becomes clouds in Alaska. El Niños were fairly common in the late 20th century, but have only shown up twice since 1998. Toman says because the jet stream is fairly weak in the summer, El Niño's effects to the north can vary, but a general pattern can still be seen in records of past events that developed between spring and summer.
when that's happened in the past, that has correlated with active fire years. It also does correlate to some extent with at least not cool summers, especially in coastal Alaska.
The reason for the greater fire risk is thunderstorms.
Because to get thunderstorms, of course, you need some moisture. Last year was a very warm summer across mainland Alaska, but there was unusually low thunderstorm activity, and that was a result of that big high-pressure loft and really a lack of low-level moisture. So to some extent, we need that moisture to get thunderstorms across inland Alaska.
The Climate Prediction Center says there is now a 65% likelihood of an El Niño developing this summer. Aftershocks are continuing to rattle the western edge of the Brooks Range near communities like Noatak, and now seismologists are conducting a rapid response to capture those tremors. That's after two earthquakes that came 2 weeks apart at magnitudes not recorded in the region in more than 30 years. KNOM's Anna Rose MacArthur has more.
Saturday, a 5.5 magnitude quake shook the Brooks Range after another 5.6 quake rocked the same area in April.
Our objective right now is to get instrumentation in the ground quickly.
That's Michael West, seismologist and director of the Alaska Earthquake Information Center. West has two reasons for installing the instruments.
One is aftershocks will continue, and being able to understand the aftershocks tells us something about the original earthquakes and why they happened.
The instruments are being stationed in communities closest to the quake, Kotzebue and Noatak. Seismologists installed one in Kotzebue yesterday and are installing another in Noatak today. While in Noatak, they will also hold a public meeting to address community concerns. Carol Wesley is with the Environmental Department of the Native Village of Noatak and is helping to organize the session.
For many of us, it's the first. Many of us haven't been in a real earthquake, so I guess the most important information we're hoping to get from them is what to do or not to do in the event of a big earthquake.
Wesley says there have been no reported injuries or major structural damage from the quakes, but residents are tallying over 30 aftershocks since the first quake in April. Wes from the Earthquake Center says with most seismic equipment located hundreds of miles away from these quakes, in the interior and along the southern coast, the distance can distort readings. They also can't register seismic activity below a certain threshold. West calls this deficit a liability for the state.
What all these little earthquakes do that happen in huge numbers, these magnitude ones, they happen, you know, tens of thousands every year in the state. Nobody feels them, but they allow us to map out fault zones. They allow us to pinpoint the areas where bigger earthquakes are more probable in the future.
West says the instruments being installed in Kotzebue and Noatak are temporary stations until the Earthquake Center finds more long-term solutions. Reporting in Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
A student at the University of Alaska in Anchorage has created software that can spell check the Yupik language. Yupik language experts are excited about the possibilities, even though the designer is not a fluent speaker. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
Last month on the 11th, at the ConocoPhillips Integrated Science Building in Anchorage, Eric Stephen Ivan Wesley Somerville presented a model for Yupik spell-checking software. For someone who hasn't studied computer science, his model would be useless, but by reaching the proof-of-concept phase, as it's called by designers, Somerville has overcome an important hurdle.
It's not perfect, but I've shown that it can be done.
Creating the software had many challenges, especially for someone who doesn't consider himself fluent in the Yupik language, as Somerville explains.
I'm trying to understand Yupik language, and I'm trying to translate it in my head in order to get enough understanding, in order to then teach it to a computer.
He says for someone who already speaks the language, building a word becomes automatic, but for a computer, each step must be programmed. One of the biggest challenges was
finding a way to account for what professors over here like to call morphophonological magic.
A whole English sentence can sometimes be contained in just one Yupik word, but because of the morphophonological magic, changing just one syllable will change the entire meaning of the word. Learning those rules is complicated, but fortunately for Somerville, linguists before him have been working on deciphering that code. Early efforts were made to translate the Bible. Then, half a century ago, American and Japanese linguists advanced the written translation, says UAA Yupik professor Marie Mead.
Linguists, as they're called, got together in the 60s with UAA employees and students to make a better written form for Yupik. They kept working at it until it was better.
Then in the 1980s, Stephen Jacobson created a complete breakdown of the Yupik language. His books and dictionaries are still considered the authority on the language. Somerville says he relied on that to build on his software. Mead says the integration of Jacobson's work with Somerville's software could be an important advancement.
It would be good for people who use the language. Also, a better teaching tool for checking errors.
But before that happens, Somerville has a ways to go. He envisions many possibilities for the spell checker. Once it's completed, he'd like to see it in common word processing programs.
The immediate example that comes to mind would be Microsoft Word. So there might be potential to create a plugin for that so that we're teaching Microsoft software how to speak Yupik.
Other possibilities include a smartphone app or a website that could provide immediate translations, but it's not clear how long that will take. Somerville says he'll be looking for grant funding to complete the spell checker, but if the app comes out, don't expect it to turn you into a Yupik speaker immediately. Mead says there's no app for that.
You can't learn Yupik in one try or one semester. You have to keep practicing.
For KYUK in Bethel, this is Charles Enoch.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome, and Charles Enoch in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.